You are listening to the Tricorder Transmissions, episode 55. And
now,
here are
Craig
and
Jeff.
There has their black cats with them. I know we do, and if you don't, we can probably lend you one for episode 55 of the Tricorder Transmissions Assignment Earth. We are your hosts, Jeff Hewlett
and Craig Cohen. And seriously, if anybody wants a black cat, I have one.
Well, we both have black cats. That's funny. But mine is actually not in the room. They make a little too much noise when podcasting, so I tend to try to keep them outside the room for these things. But
yeah. My guy is actually it's nice and cool here in Jersey. The summer's breaking, so the windows are open, and he's enjoying the extra kitty TV views, as we call it.
Yes, I've got the back porch. I have a screened-in porch here on my apartment, and I had the back door open so they can go out and hang out there. They love it.
Oh yeah,
out there. So beautiful day. Light week for Trek news. So not much to talk about, but one thing I did want to mention that I think is incredible, and an incredible achievement in science, and it is space related. So, you remember the Curiosity rover?
Oh yeah, up in Mars.
Yeah, so the Curiosity rover has reached one of its long term goals.
Oh yeah?
Yeah, it has reached the base of Mount Sharp, which is a 3+ mile high mountain on the surface of Mars.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah, and they're going to start doing some drilling. Earlier, they had done some drilling and found some moisture and predicted that they could have had some life on Mars. It could have supported microbes, and they're going to be doing some more drilling to look for more evidence of potential life on Mars.
That is really exciting. Yeah. Just really, really great to see that kind of progress being made
in our lifetime, man.
Yeah, and I mean,
it's incredible.
It's really, really remarkable, considering how far away that planet is.
Really, and imagine the implications. I mean, this could be an hours long discussion, but imagine the implications if they actually did find some evidence of life there. That would be so mind blowing.
Yeah,
can't even imagine. But so congratulations to NASA and the Curiosity rover, and fans of science everywhere. So this is a big thing to see happen. So
yeah, it's awesome.
Very, very cool. So that concludes any of the news pieces we wanted to talk about. So what we want to do with the rest of this intro time is talk about some incredible things that are coming up in the very, very near future for the Tricorder Transmissions. One of the big ones. You know what, Craig, why don't you take this one?
Sure thing, yeah. We might be through with the news, but that doesn't mean we don't have a lot of exciting news on the Tricorder Transmissions front to share with you. We are very, very excited about an interview that we'll be sharing with you soon. We'll be recording it soon and sharing it with you soon, and we have high hopes for it, and we're very excited. We're going to be talking with Mark Cushman, who is the author of two volumes right now of what is going to be a three-volume set called These Are the Voyages. And we've talked about the book on the show before, and it really is the definitive guide to Star Trek, the original series. It sort of serves multiple purposes. It's an episode guide. It's also a production diary, if you will. It's really an incredible historical look at Star Trek, the original series. It is incredibly researched. There's information that Cushman is presenting here that has never been seen by the general public. And it's a book that has been in the works for over 30 years and had the approval and blessing of Gene Roddenberry. So We really look forward to talking to him, and we know you're all are really, really going to love the conversation we have with Mr. Cushman.
Absolutely. And I know everybody out there is sick to death of us talking about the convention, but we did actually meet up with Mark Cushman at the convention, and he's a really cool guy, and he was enthusiastic about coming on the show. So I'm really excited about this.
And that's where you got your two volumes signed in person.
Yes, I got volumes 1 and 2 signed by Mark Cushman, and I am currently in the middle of reading. I'm about 2/3 of the way through reading the first book, and I've been really taking my time with it because it's so detailed and there's so much to take in. It's one of those books that you could probably read over and over and over again and just keep finding new things in it.
Oh, totally.
Really, yeah. Incredible stuff.
Yeah, and I know we'll get the story from Mark, but there's a very funny Leonard Nimoy story related to the publishing of the season one book.
Yeah, that's really cool, and I definitely want to ask him about that when we get him on. But
so yeah, I mean, that is, you know, one of our sort of stretch goals, if you will, with this podcast, was to talk to people that we were really you know, that we really respected, and Mr. Cushman is definitely one of those people that we're very, very excited to have on the show.
Absolutely. And some other people that we're very excited to have on the show, and this has been a really quick turnaround on this one. We are going to be doing an interview very shortly with the Red Shirt Diaries folks. So Ashley and Jason from the new web series, the Red Shirt Diaries, will be on the Tricorder Transmissions probably later on this week. So look for that. I think we're going to probably be hitting that one out on probably Wednesday evening.
Yeah. So right now there's they release every Monday. And yeah, there's what, it's going to be an 8 or 10 episode series?
The original article that I read said 10 episodes, and that may be what they have recorded already. So I plan to ask them when we get them on if they're going to proceed any further with this, because it seems like something they could do for every episode.
Oh, sure. Yeah. And they're pretty early on, so you can still get on board early. They're only mm-hmm. 2 episodes in. The third episode will go up tomorrow, actually.
Yep.
And they're about 3 minutes each.
Yeah,
so
they're very bite-sized.
Yeah, and like Jeff said, we'll get all the information about it from them. But it's a really, really cool concept. It's sort of like a personal log from a security crew member. And each entry takes place during an episode of the original series.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. She brings in – it's very well-researched. I don't want to delve too far into it, because we're going to be going very, very deep with them when we talk to them. But they are obviously fans of the original series. They do their research. They even, some other characters even appear on the episodes. I don't want to ruin it for anybody. And like I said before, it's very bite-sized. They're short episodes. They're not a big time commitment. And there's a lot of laughs in there, and it's fun to watch. So, you know, get out there and take a look at these and come back and visit us around Wednesday of this week, and you'll hear all about the making of and the writing of and production of this web series.
Yeah.
Yeah. And also, and we're not done with big stuff, another thing that we're both very excited about, because we did this once for the first season, and we are about to jump into our second season, 2-part wrap-up episode, and we have got a ton of guests lined up to come on and talk about the second season of Trek with us.
Yeah, well, it's amazing if you look at where we were at the end of season one mm-hmm. and where we are today. Our Tricorder Transmissions family has gotten so much bigger.
It's incredible.
It's really great, the sort of organic growth that we've had. So a lot of the people that we've met and interacted with are going to find their way onto our season 2 wrap up, and like you said, yeah, I'm really, really looking forward to it. It's sort of a great way to look back at the season we've just talked about, and make some adjustments to make possibly our opinions, and then also cleanse the palate a little bit before we move on to season 3.
Yeah, yeah, I'm really looking forward to it. Just to give you guys a little taste, we've already got commitments from Donnie Versaggia. We met him at the convention. He's that 3D digital artist who does those amazing Trek interiors. of the ships, and he's working on a game currently. He's a really great guy. We've got a commitment from Matt Walsky, one of our frequent commenters on our Facebook page and our forums. Looking forward to having him. He's from the UK, so we're going to have our first European contributor
in
one of our episodes. A friend of the show, Chris Ritzer, who's part of the Super Panel, has committed to being on. We also have a tentative potential contribution coming from friend of the show, Steve. It's been hard to nail him down, but I'm going to call him out on this intro, and hopefully that'll light a fire under him, and he'll commit to giving us a little bit of his time and his voice.
Oh, that would be excellent. I would love to have Steve come on and be part of the show. That's great.
Yeah, and maybe even we'll throw a friend of the show, Dave, in there as well, and he knows who he is.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, he listens and talks to me about it constantly, so maybe he'll also have some time to offer his views on the second season.
Perfect. And there'll be other voices that'll probably pop on, little treats for everyone. So, it's gonna be the next 2 weeks after today.
Yes, after Assignment Earth launches, we will be doing a two-parter. I can't guarantee they won't run long because we've got so many guests coming on. We have a potential to run very long episodes. So hopefully you guys out there don't mind. We didn't get any complaints about the extremely long part two of the Vegas convention wrap-up episode. So hopefully that'll go over well with everybody out there. So are you ready, Craig, to jump into Assignment Earth?
yes.
Oh, man. I have a feeling that Craig's going to be a little bit punchy for this recording. All right. So Assignment Earth aired on March 29th of 1968. The remaster was May 3rd, 2008.
Yeah, and I have a write-up here, and it is from the NBC press release issued February 27th, 1968. The Enterprise crew returns to the 20th century to learn how the Earth survived 1968 and nearly witnesses the destruction of the world in Assignment Earth on the NBC television network's Star Trek Colorcast, Friday, March 29th.
All right. You want to count us in this time?
Sure thing. We will start our scene-specific commentary of Assignment Earth in 3, 2, 1. So, I don't know, right off the bat, this episode really makes me sort of raise my eyebrow, Spock style.
Well, I can understand why you would be raising your eyebrow, but I raise my eyebrow maybe in a slightly different way. Tell me what makes you raise your eyebrow for this one.
Well, the fact that Starfleet is seemingly using the time travel device just for observational purposes.
Yes, that is one thing that I think opens this episode, and actually even the Star Trek series as a whole, Starfleet as a whole, because this is something that we've never seen before. First of all, they're reusing a time travel method that Spock and company actually invented, essentially. They were the first ones to have done that, wasn't it? It was a theoretical slingshot around the sun.
Yeah.
They're calling it the light speed breakaway.
Yeah.
And they used that in the previous time that they visited Earth, which was Tomorrow is Yesterday?
I believe so,
Captain Christopher? Yeah. So they used it then. And now I guess they can recreate that and use it whenever they want and control it to go wherever they want to go. So one has to wonder, is this the kind of stuff that the other ships are doing? Is Starfleet sending other ships into the past, or is this something that you need Spock to do?
Yeah, the whole thing seems very, very dangerous to me.
Yeah, it does. It seems like there's a lot of potential for, you know, changing of the past, or, you know, if somebody, supposedly they have some sort of a deflector that can keep them from being detected, but still, you know, obviously things like what just happened could happen anytime they travel back. And knowing what we know about Starfleet, that we have a ton of captains out there who are very corruptible and who take they take every opportunity to conquer or take over other civilizations.
Yeah.
So, you know, what's to stop one of these rogue captains or highly impressionable captains from going back in time using the Spock method and, you know, taking over Earth?
Yeah. Well, and I guess this sort of can point towards the Tribbles episode they did on Deep Space Nine that sort of involved what, like time cops, for lack of a better word.
Yeah, I guess they must have come later on, and in that episode, those time police actually knew James Kirk very well.
Yeah, and it's funny because they say he's one of the biggest offenders of what, time travel abuse.
Yeah, he has so many violations on the books. Yeah.
Which is funny considering how many, like you said, corruptible captains there are. So I wanted to also point out real quick before we continue that this makes you wonder if there was a trend here where the name of this episode is Assignment : Earth.
Mm-hmm.
And as we know, the end of season one was Operation : Annihilate.
Yes.
So I don't know if there was a mandate from Roddenberry that every season had to end with a colon in the title.
Yeah. Unfortunately, the last episode of the third season doesn't.
Yeah.
But that would have been pretty cool. But one thing about this, since you're talking about the title of the episode, one thing that this episode has that other episodes don't is that the primary guest star is credited in the opening credits, not just in the end credits.
Right, right.
So Robert Lansing's Gary Seven character was actually credited right here after the fade-up. And you saw him in a couple other credits, too. So this is the only episode where they actually have those credits superimposed over the show.
Yeah, that was something I didn't notice. But I guess we should also talk about now that this was actually supposed to be sort of a backdoor pilot to a new series.
Yes, and this is the only Trek episode that was an attempted spinoff. And that was supposed to be a show about this Gary Seven character who we're going to find out is a space traveler. And later on, we'll find, if you read the books that he's been in, he's also a time traveler. And Terry Garr is his assistant. And he's got this this cat. Oh, by the way, since we're at the beginning of this episode and we're talking about the Gary character, I want to mention that the cat, Isis, was actually played by three different cats.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. There was a little bit of a snippet of an interview with Robert Lansing. I'm not going to read the entire thing, but he did say they have three cats, and the reason why was because people felt you couldn't train cats back then, so they tried to have three different black cats who would they would rotate in and out depending on how they took to certain actors,
right,
or actresses. So one particular cat, I believe his name was Sambo. Which I don't know, that might not be the best name for a cat, but kind of took to him, and they did some ad lib scenes with this cat that loved to climb all over him. So pretty cool. And if you want to try to challenge yourself, watch the scenes with the cats and see if you can spot different cats.
Oh wow!
Yeah.
So we just had a pretty important moment.
Yep.
Where the Vulcan nerve pinch did not work on a human.
Yes, he is the first human, an actual human, that we've seen that the nerve pinch did not work on.
Yeah.
And they'll actually mention this. So they'll actually, Kirk will actually refer to it as the Vulcan nerve pinch and kind of be amazed that Seven was immune to its effects.
Yeah. You know what else is amazing? As we watch Spock sort of get some what looks like therapy from this cat, petting it, and I don't know, he seems to be enjoying it as much as a Vulcan can. But the amazing timing that the Enterprise had, yes, beaming Gary Seven up. I mean, I'd love to see Spock's mathematical odds of that ever happening.
Yeah, and I'm kind of amazed that. This is something that I don't know if we've seen before or we'll see again, is the Enterprise is capable of, not only capable of intercepting a transporter beam, but it seems like it was involuntary. They weren't trying to intercept it. It just kind of flew through the Enterprise and was just kind of he was materializing right there.
Is it like scanning for Wi-Fi?
I mean, you know, that's a good question.
You know, whereas like your phone always knows when it can connect to a Wi-Fi signal.
Yeah, I mean, well, yeah, I get maybe the transporter in this day and age, or in Star Trek's day and age, was programmed to just receive whatever beam happened to, you know, be in the area. So if it picks up a transporter signal, it just grabs it and sucks it in. So yeah. That's the only thing I can really think of that makes sense. But interesting thing, this is another something that really made my head explode when I thought about it, was that Gary Seven claims that humans were taken from Earth and trained to be agents of some sort by this alien race that prefers to remain anonymous, right?
Yeah.
This is the thing that really scrambles my brain, because, you know, you're all this season we've been getting smacked in the head with the Prime Directive over and over and over again, and how Starfleet really wants to stick to this, and captains are sworn to die to protect the Prime Directive and blah, blah, blah. But obviously this alien race, who has superior technology, doesn't give a damn about Prime Directives.
Yeah.
And they're directly interfering with Earth's evolution.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Go ahead.
I was going to say real quick, I wanted to point out Gary's pen device here.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Because if you're familiar with Doctor Who, he has a device called the Sonic Screwdriver.
Mm-hmm.
And this device Gary had made me instantly think of the Doctor's Sonic Screwdriver.
Mm.
So I went back and I looked to see when the Sonic Screwdriver was introduced into the Doctor Who mythology. And Doctor Who debuted in 1963, so a couple years before Trek. But interestingly enough, the Sonic Screwdriver was not introduced into the Doctor Who canon until the 6-part serial Fury from the Deep that started in March of 68, March 16th to be exact. So a week or two before this episode aired. And it is also one of the Doctor Who stories that is completely missing, meaning that the BBC wiped the tapes and there's no actual record of those right now. So it is, I guess, one of the holy grails of Doctor Who video. But I thought it was neat that the sort of the Sonic Screwdriver or the amazing pen concept hit the airwaves within a couple of weeks of each other.
Yeah, it's a pretty cool coincidence.
Yeah, yeah.
Cool. So we just learned two new things, by the way. One, that the doors in the Enterprise can be opened by a cat twice. So the cat can leave the room and get into the transporter room. And it only opened wide enough for the cat to walk in, by the way.
Yeah.
And this is something that is a head scratcher, because they constantly say in Star Trek, someone has to stay behind and operate the transporter. But Gary Seven just solo transported without anybody operating the controls.
Yeah. I think we've seen like one other time, didn't we?
I believe we did, but that's something that they smack you in the face with a lot. They use that as a plot device, that somebody has to stay behind.
Yeah.
And operate.
So here's Gary's like TARDIS, for lack of a better word.
Yeah.
I don't know. For me, I got a big sort of Doctor Who vibe from this. And, you know, Gary and the Doctor are very, very different characters. But the idea of what they were trying to do with Assignment Earth in terms of spinning it off into a TV show very much sort of seemed like an American version of Doctor Who, in the sense that you have this sort of enigmatic man who's got powers of some kind, and he's traveling and having adventures with a young female.
Yes.
So I don't know if that was by design or if it was just a coincidence, but as a Doctor Who fan, it was just, you know, watching this episode, it just felt like this could have been the American attempt at introducing it.
Yeah, perhaps. Recognize any parts of that computer?
Should I?
Yes, you should.
Oh.
Parts of it are from the M5 computer.
From
the Ultimate Computer. So they recycled pieces of M5 for this episode. And you'll see more M5 parts in the third season. But we have a talking computer by the name of Beta 5. And very strange, but it seems to be a lot more advanced than the computers on the Enterprise. It almost seems to be sentient in a way. It refers to itself as I.
Yeah.
And it's capable of analytical decisions. And it seems to be able to converse with Gary 7 almost as if it was having a human conversation, which is very predictive of what is coming into being today in 2014, you know, with our smartphones and the various talking assistants that can listen to your language, understand and respond. But this still seems a little more, this Trek episode seems a little more advanced than what we have now. So
yeah,
once again, very cool that Star Trek in the late 60s was predicting future technology that we're still just starting to see in our own time. That's something I really love about this show. Did you notice, by the way, that, you know, Gary, when he looked out the window, he referred to the Earth's society or the goings on outside as primitive.
Yeah.
So that calls into question whether he's a person from Earth who was pulled from, you know, sometime in the past and just sent back here, because why would he call it primitive?
Yeah. And you mentioned, I guess, some of the books that they've written about Gary 7.
Mm-hmm.
And also what in the Humble Bundle that we talked about last week. One of the rewards was what, a 5-issue run of Assignment Earth that IDW published?
Yep.
So, yeah, it seems like there might be some interesting stories there that sort of give some insight into the Gary 7 character if people wanted to go down that rabbit hole.
Yep, and he's also been in a couple of Trek novels and other comic books as well. So he has recurred, just not in television or movie.
Now, what was your initial takeaway the first time you saw this episode?
You going to make me flip my hand now?
Well, no. I mean, like, way back, whenever it was.
Well, I loved it. So, yeah. But when I was younger, I thought this was incredible. I really, really liked this episode a lot when I was a kid.
And was it the fact that it had a time travel element, or?
No, it was more like I liked that it was Star Trek with like a James Bond sort of character. I thought that this guy was really cool. He wasn't Gary 7, you don't really know if he's a hero or a villain until the very, very end of the episode. They just keep you guessing. And I thought the character was kind of cool. He was mysterious, a little bit dark, and he had that awesome cat, that trained cat, and cool computer stuff, and he could teleport all over the place, and you know, he had that awesome pen gadget that could kind of knock you out and make you happy. And
yeah,
I just thought it was really well done, and I liked some of these Earth scenes here. It was really neat because it didn't feel as dated to me when I was younger as it looks dated now, of course. Yeah. But I don't know. And the effects in this episode are so cool. They must have blown a hell of a budget on effects for this, because you got these, you know, his little badges just kind of beamed in there, and you know, you had this the computer with the cool lights and the talking, and you had that the big safe with the teleporter inside. I don't know. I don't know what's not to like, to be honest. Yeah. When I was a kid, I thought this was spectacular.
Yeah, and I think they probably had maybe a double budget to work with, considering that this was supposed to be the sort of a backdoor pilot.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
But for me, it was one of those things where there was sort of an initial burst of confusion, where at a certain point you're checking the channel to make sure you didn't move to another show, because there's huge chunks of the episode where there's no Star Trek people.
But yeah. I mean, I can understand that.
Which I'd imagine had to be kind of off-putting for people watching this, you know, on the night it debuted in 68.
I don't know. I don't know. I'd have to talk to my uncle and see what he has to say, because he remembers watching this when he was younger. I don't know. I don't think that the scenes minus the Trek people are not in, engaging or interesting.
Oh, not at all. Not at all.
You know, and yeah, the series does throw a lot of curveballs your way and without explanation in the past. So I don't know. I'm not sure. I'd have to ask a few people and see.
Yeah, I think it would be one of those cases of somebody being like, I want a little bit more Star Trek in my Star Trek episode. But the other thing that I think is kind of neat about this is sort of how blasé Earth's past has become to Kirk and Spock.
Yeah. Well, notice that they're in their proper costumes again. They've come down in business suits and coats, so they're mingling into society much better in this episode than they did in, say, you know, Bread and Circuses.
Yeah.
But interesting thing that Gary Seven said a few minutes ago that really stuck out to me was he said in the context of this episode that Earth technology and science has progressed faster than political and social knowledge.
Yeah.
So, you know, the one of the things that's going on in this episode is this is like a heavy nuclear period. So you have the fear of nuclear war, you know, looming, and the U.S. is about to launch some sort of a missile platform into space. And Gary Seven is here to either sabotage it, or we're not sure if he's going to start a war or he's looking to stop a war. So that's kind of the conflict here for the audience to figure out and for Kirk and Spock to figure out. But I thought it was pretty neat that they, once again, they're taking on the fears of the day.
Yeah.
And creating a science fiction story out of it.
Oh, yeah. Totally. Totally. Mm-hmm. So we've passed the point of the introduction of the Roberta Lincoln character played by Terry Garr, who for me seems like sort of the trivia question that you might use to say, you know, name a guest star on Star Trek, the original series, you know, and name them all. And Terry Garr might be the one that people sort of overlook.
And she's also the one that refuses to talk about her Star Trek experience in interviews.
Is that true?
Yes.
Wow. I wonder why that is.
Well, there supposedly it had a lot to do with the difficulties with her costume and, the short skirts and everything, and she apparently had a very bad time filming this episode and you know, just chooses not to talk about it.
Wow, that's amazing and kind of unfortunate.
Yeah, I think it is too. It's kind of sad because I thought her character in this was pretty cool.
Yeah, I thought the Roberta Lincoln character was very neat, and I don't know, I've always sort of enjoyed Terry Garr. I think she's a really talented performer, and you know, I constantly think of her in Mr. Mom, which was such a good movie, and I thought her performance in that was really, really great.
I agree. Now that cat that just ran in, by the way, looks like a different cat than the one Spock was holding.
Yeah, you know what? It's funny. I'm gonna have to go back and definitely take a look at the different Isis cats and play the game that you proposed at the beginning of the episode.
Yeah, it would be pretty fun.
Yeah.
So in order to disguise his real purpose, Gary Seven claimed that he was doing research for an encyclopedia. Remember those?
Yeah.
Remember encyclopedias? Oh, there's a wool hat again on Spock. They always pick the wool hats to cover his ears.
Yeah, and this set seems much, much different than the set that we got in, like, The City on the Edge of Forever.
Yes, yeah. It definitely does. I think these were actually buildings on the Paramount lot, weren't they?
Possibly, yeah.
I believe that they were. And similar to some of the previous episodes that they used actual buildings from the lot, like a piece of the action.
Yeah.
Yeah, so... And what was the Patterns of Force used some of the buildings. So I think this is another one of those recycles where they just used buildings that were already existing instead of building new ones, which is an intelligent way to go.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
But so, it's funny to think that this is another the amount of times that the crew was in, you know, late 60s or any period from the 30s to the late 60s of American history, even if they weren't on Earth during this season.
Yeah. Well, funny, this is the only episode that I can remember that takes place entirely in the past. I mean, the other ones there, you see them in the future traveling to the past or from the past going back to the future. This opens in 1968 and closes in 1968.
Wow. Yeah, that's another thing I didn't realize.
Yeah, so you don't actually do any real time travel in this episode. You're just supposed to assume. Now, did you notice that Scotty was able to calculate Gary Seven's location so precisely that he could walk Kirk and Spock to exactly where he was? They're saying, by the way, he's 30 meters above you. So obviously he's in the building, right? So if he could calculate it that close, why couldn't he just beam them closer?
Yeah.
This seemed kind of silly. But we also found out that there were two other agents involved in this, whatever Gary Seven is working on, whatever his mission is. And they died in a car crash. So that's pretty sad. There's another a shot of a phaser blowing a door lock. That's a constant thing. Great smoke effect, though.
Yeah.
Yeah, they went over and above there on that effect. I mean, they didn't even need to do that at all. I mean, it was nice that they... Now, I love how when the doors open, you see that blue swirly smoke, and he just kind of saunters out.
Yeah.
And this guy walks by like they didn't even notice it. I love that. So it makes me wonder if people see him teleporting or they don't see it until, you know, he's fully there or how that works.
Yeah, or it's just a really unobservant guy on a government base.
Well, there were a whole bunch of people with that lunch cart right in front of it, too.
Yeah, that lunch cart looks awesome.
It does. It does. It looks like one of the ones you have to hook up to a truck and tow away, though.
Yeah.
So I don't think it's an actual real truck. The truck. And you know, when they were wrestling with Terry Garr a minute ago, and she's trying to get on the phone to call the cops, Kirk says, "Give me the phone." I love that he knows what a phone is.
Yeah.
He was obviously born in a time where there were no phones. The Enterprise doesn't have phones. So unless he's 34-ish years old. So I can't imagine that there were phones at any point in his life.
Yeah,
but he knows enough to know that was called a phone.
Yeah.
That's great. Oh, man.
So, yeah, and you'd think that phones would have been really, you know, outside of, you know, being known for probably decades, if not hundreds of years.
So, you know, here we go again. You know, the transporter seems so inconsistent. Sometimes they can beam precise things up from precise locations, and other times they do like an area-wide beam, and they beam up people that don't need to be beamed up, and you know, they beam up these cops. So now history has officially changed, by the way, because these cops have now seen the interior of a spaceship briefly.
Yeah, but I mean, for that's just one of those alien abduction stories, probably.
Maybe.
And
Garr saw them beam down. So she's seen people teleport. So interesting. It's funny. So here we are at a base again.
Her whole interaction with Gary Seven is troublesome from a prime directive standpoint, even though, you said, Gary and his people don't really recognize that.
Yeah, well, you know, back to that, what are the implications of what this episode is essentially saying? So this episode is implying that there are people who come to Earth from an alien planet to direct the evolution of civilization on Earth.
Yeah.
So, I mean, everything essentially that happens on Earth, we don't know when they started doing this or how long they did this into the future. But, I mean, are we responsible for any of our own evolution at this point? And who are these aliens to decide what will and won't happen on Earth? Like, you know, they didn't come and stop these other nations from launching missile platforms into space, but they're going to stop the United States from doing it.
Yeah.
Very, very strange.
Well, it almost seems like it's sort of like almost the Doc Brown theory of time travel, where it's just... you know, it's better off just to not get involved and just, you know,
I guess, but
yeah, but look how Doc Brown turned out.
Well, yeah, you know, you would think that these alien people would have come and maybe stopped other tragic things from happening. I mean, you know, we've heard about the eugenics wars, and I think there was an actual novel somewhere, one of the eugenics wars novels, where Gary Seven did actually show up and had some interaction with Khan or Khan's people. I haven't read it, but maybe someday I will. But, you know, it's very interesting to think about all of the things. I mean, maybe are they responsible for or partially responsible for the creation of Starfleet and launching man into these space exploration type scenarios? I mean,
and then what kind of paradox does that create?
Exactly. Well, yeah, the end of this episode is completely paradoxical, by the way. We'll get to that when we get there.
Yeah.
But, you know, so now we see, you know, I realized as I was watching this earlier that this reminded me of something. And you have Gary Seven, who is going to be sabotaging a rocket here. He's going to be climbing around on some rigging and sabotaging this rocket. We don't know what the purpose is, but doesn't this remind you of Men in Black 3?
Yes.
Doesn't it seem like just almost a blatant ripoff of this episode in a way?
Yeah, but at least the time travel in this episode makes sense.
I guess so. I guess so.
Not to get into whole Men in Black 3 discussion, but the time travel in that movie didn't make any sense.
No, it didn't. But, well, now we've also found out that Scotty can somehow bounce off signals off of weather satellites and get very close-up pictures of Earth, almost like Google Earth today.
Yeah.
So he's, you know, here's Star Trek showing you very advanced satellite photography. That, I mean, I'm sure you had satellite photography back then, but what Scotty's doing, I mean, he's zeroing in on very small and very precise locations from outer space. And only, you know, we know we can do this today, and we can go online right now and go to, you know, Google Maps and zoom in on the satellite view and see our own houses and
yeah,
all that kind of stuff. But back then, I mean, that had to be pretty mind-blowing to see that.
Oh, totally.
Incredible. So one more thing that's very commonplace today and must have seemed like a impossibility, you know, back in the 60s. But look how he had to hide in the trunk. Couldn't he just teleport where he needed to go?
Yeah.
But does he need a door to come out of? Is that the problem?
Well, the trunk, he could have teleported into the trunk.
Yeah, maybe. But the car wasn't there initially.
Yeah. I mean,
maybe he could. Maybe there's no doorway suitable enough for him on this rocket rig, so he couldn't necessarily use it. But
yeah. So, do you want to talk about Robert Lansing a little bit?
Sure, go for it.
Robert Lansing died in 1994 at the age of 66, and he had a pretty long career, known for shows like The 87th Precinct, 12 O'Clock High, Branded, The Equalizer.
Hey.
And in the 90s, Kung Fu, The Legend Continues.
Yep. Yeah. Classic stuff. I love The Equalizer, too.
Yeah.
That was one of
and I guess we should also talk about the people behind this episode while we have a minute.
Sure.
The story for this episode was written by or conceived by Gene Roddenberry and Art Wallace. And Art Wallace had worked with Roddenberry on The Lieutenant. And he was also very, very involved in the TV show in the late 60s and early 70s, The Dark Shadows.
Ah, okay.
Yeah. And this is also the director of this episode is Mark Daniels, a director that we've seen many times before. He directed 15 episodes total. The last was by Any Other Name.
Oh.
And at the start of season 3, we're going to see his last episode. So we'll be saying goodbye to Mark Daniel shortly with Spock's brain. But he directed some really, really important Trek episodes. If you don't remember, he directed The Man Trap, Space Seed, Mirror Mirror, and I'm Mud, among many others.
Got a lot of winners under his belt.
Yeah, so we've said goodbye to a couple of directors already. So we're getting ready to say goodbye to Mark Daniels.
Yeah. Well, he will be missed.
Yes.
He will be missed. And Spock's hat, by the way, is incredible. I don't know what prop closet, what wardrobe closet they pulled that out of, but Man, that is a great hat.
Yeah, and you know, that seems like it could be some fun cosplay if you have a duo. You know, you can do the Kirk Spock, Simon Earth cosplay.
That would be really cool. We need somebody to do the Roberta Lincoln cosplay too.
I'm surprised, you know, considering you know, a lot of the cosplay we see is very, very creative.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And you know, we saw some very obscure cosplay in Vegas, so it is kind of surprising that we haven't seen a Roberta Lincoln costume yet.
Yeah, well, strangely, I mean, you know, this episode, I've talked to a few people over the course of the last couple of weeks about, you know, the end of season two, and it seems like a lot of people that I talk to just don't like this episode at all.
Yeah, it's definitely understandable because, like you said, it's entertaining, but on the other side of it, it's there's not a lot of Star Trek going on.
Mm.
You know, there's not a lot of Star Trekking.
No, that's true. That's true.
This is an amazing visual here, the Gary and the cat.
Yeah. Well, this is one of the ad-libbed scenes,
by the way. Oh, really?
Yeah, the cat was just kind of climbing all over him. This was the cat that really, really liked him. So it's just, and he was kind of ad-libbing the, you know, hey, you're getting in the way, I got a job to do kind of stuff.
Oh, that's funny.
So pretty cool. Now, wouldn't you think just pulling out one or two of those wires would be sabotage enough?
Oh, totally.
I mean, you know, everything on a rocket is pretty precise. So you have to wonder if... You know, it's a little bit of overkill. Even the rocket would even launch with a lot of those wires detached.
Yeah.
So who knows? I'm no rocket scientist, though.
So this is the Spock hat you were referring to?
There it is.
Yeah.
Kind of almost looks like something you'd see on Gilligan's Island.
Yeah.
Doesn't it? That's funny. There's some cool footage here of the control rooms, though.
Oh, yeah. I'd imagine that this was pretty mind-blowing stuff to see in 1968.
Yeah, that was all shots from actual military installations and you know, rocket launch control rooms. So pretty cool. They stuck a lot of that footage in, a lot of the still backdrops and things that they used. Like, I love the visual here. It actually, to me, I always thought it looked like he really was on some sort of a rig.
Oh yeah,
you know, pulling the wires out. I know it's a backdrop and everything, and he's probably only like 2 feet off the ground, but. I always thought it was pulled off very well.
Oh, yeah, totally.
Yeah. And especially if you look at some of the effects in some other episodes of Trek in the past, you know, where the budget... Look at the hat. Where the budget was really, really tight. I mean, this one, it really seems like they had some kind of carte blanche to spend money.
Yeah, which sort of makes the fact that the spinoff never happened kind of makes you scratch your head a little bit.
There were shows back then that were sort of similar to what this show would have been. So it's amazing to me that they didn't even try it.
Yeah.
You know, at least for a season or shoot a pilot, because there isn't even a pilot out there.
Yeah.
Of what that show would have been.
Unless the executives looked at Star Trek and the budget Star Trek was working with and the results they were getting from a rating standpoint with Star Trek and, you know, just did some simple math and said, wow, a Simon Earth would be another big investment that might not get great returns.
Yeah, you know, it would probably have to be pretty high budget because they're setting the bar for it pretty high here.
Yeah.
As far as sets and effects are concerned. Now, here's a very interesting inconsistency.
Yes.
Now, Gary Seven is beamed up to the Enterprise and he's beamed in a sitting position.
Okay.
Now, in the past, we've seen people beamed in an action pose and show up standing straight up.
Yeah.
And we've also seen people beamed and appear in the same exact position that they were transported in. So it's tough to find any consistency in the transporter.
Yeah.
And, of course, it was beamed back down again and still in a sitting position. So interesting. I wonder what governed that. I wonder if that was a directorial choice in episodes, the position that the person was in. I mean, because obviously they didn't really, I mean, who was doing continuity back then? I don't know if they had a person dedicated to that or if it was just the director's job. But, you know, it just seems inconsistent to me.
Oh, totally.
So I found it kind of interesting that Scotty is able to, in this scenario, beam Gary Seven to the Enterprise using just a visual fix. He doesn't actually have a communicator on him or anything of the sort that would allow him to lock onto him. He just is able to zero in using his Google Earth weather satellites, sees him on the rig, and just beams him up.
Yeah.
So very, very strange.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And how is Captain Kirk doing a captain's log from captivity here on the military base?
Yeah, that kind of seemed very, very weird to me and a little bit of a head scratcher.
Hmm. Very, very strange. So now
I guess that was a retroactive supplemental.
Yeah, potentially.
But then at that point, how accurate can it be?
Hmm. Well, and he was talking as if he was in the present.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
When he was making it. So if he was actually recording that later and we were just hearing it in the past, why would he record it, you know, back in his quarters or back on the ship as if he was living it at the moment? Yeah. You know, you don't write your journal as if you were living it at the time you're writing it, right?
Uh-huh.
You do a kind of a recap of the past, you know, went to the store. You don't write down, I'm on my way to the store. It's the skies are blue. They, you know, have to stop at a red light. You know, you don't do that. But very interesting. Very interesting. Yeah. So the rocket is launching and Kirk and Spock are powerless to do anything about it.
Yeah, that's the other sort of really interesting thing about this episode is how Kirk and Spock are really almost reduced to, at points, being observers.
Yes. Well, from what I understand, the early scripts, the early versions of this story did not feature any Star Trek characters.
Wow, which I'd imagine probably didn't go over too well with the network.
Yeah, well, I don't believe it was supposed to be a Star Trek episode. I think Gene Roddenberry was kind of hedging his bets with the ratings on Trek going down. And he was trying to score another series at the time. So this might have been one of the other ideas that was floating around out there. It was a script that was adapted to be a Star Trek episode.
Yeah.
From what I understand. So very, very interesting. You're going to have a really cool exchange here between Roberta and Gary Seven. She's convinced that he is up to no good.
Yeah.
And she's going to try to stop him. I love how he shoots the phone cable with his little pen thing, and the phone cable explodes. How awesome is that?
Yeah, and I think that was Gary going for, like, a real visual sort of thing, whereas you think the pen could have really just disabled the phone.
You would think. Or he could have just knocked her out like he did everybody else.
Yeah, yeah. So it was kind of a cool little choice on his part to go with a very theatrical presentation there.
Yeah, he seems to actually like her for some reason.
Yeah.
Although their relationship is not really explored.
Well, it would have been explored in Assignment Earth Season 1.
Yes, it would have. Yes, it would have. So I still would like to see this spinoff, guys. And if anybody's listening out there who has the capability of making it, let's go. We're doing fan episodes of Trek anyway. Let's do one. Why not?
Yeah, right?
Yeah. Well, now Terry R is pretty. Roberta is pretty helpless as well. It seems like everybody's helpless to stop Gary at this point.
You know what? This could actually be a cool sort of side mission for the 5-year mission guys.
Hmm.
You know, they could eventually do Assignment Earth Season 1.
There you go.
Or Year 1.
There you go. Or the Star Trek Continues guys. Could do something with this. Yeah, who knows? So the warhead is being armed. And now we really don't know. I mean, what is he going to do? Is he going to blow up another country and start a war? What is he going to do? And I love this move by Roberta, picking up this... whatever that is, some kind of like metal-looking box, and she's going to crown him. Now, how cool is this? Now, we're actually getting a little bit of insight into Uhura. She's listening to foreign languages, and she is able to understand them, and she's going to tell the rest of the bridge crew that there are they're beginning to worry down on Earth. Military alerts from all the major powers. So Uhura is a linguist. She can understand many languages. So very cool.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, very cool. I like that. So a little bit of extra knowledge about Uhura there. So this is the Kirk is going to seize the opportunity to escape while everyone is distracted.
Now I got to pay attention here because I couldn't recall if they actually get both sets of communicators and phasers.
Oh, that's a good call. Let's watch this and see. It doesn't look like they do.
Yeah, unless they were somehow beamed up. Because,
I don't know, man. We'll have to try to watch close. Mm-hmm. Oh, so Gary got beamed.
Yeah, he gets jobbed out by Roberta, whereas he was able to take the nerve pinch like a boss.
Yeah, and she's smart enough to take the pen out of his pocket.
Yeah.
That special pen of his. That was pretty cool of her. She's pretty slick.
Yeah.
I got to give it to her. And she's quite a nationalist. Yeah. She's a, you're not ruining my country. And this is pretty cool too, because there's once again we get a reference to the hippie movement.
Yeah.
From Roberta, who says some of my generation are kind of crazy and rebels, and we wonder if we're going to be alive by the time we're 30. So yet another appearance of the youth and the difference in attitude. Of the hippie movement and the younger people who were protesting the wars and the counterculture of the time.
Uh-huh.
So pretty cool. And there's one communicator, and Spock is going to monkey with it. And there's your nerve pinch. And here we go. They got him.
Oh, okay, everything was collected.
They got him, and they left the revolver.
All right, that might have been what threw me off. I didn't catch that was the butt of a revolver there.
Yeah. And here's another instance of direct beaming, by the way. They're beaming directly to Gary Seven's apartment.
Yeah, and I kind of thought it was interesting that the sound of the beaming was not noticed.
Hmm. That's interesting. So you wonder if the beaming sound actually is a sound or it's just something for us to hear.
Yeah, or does it only happen on the when you're actually on a transporter pad?
Hmm. That's a good question.
Now, it brings up the question of why do we even need transporter pads?
Yeah, well, I wonder if the direct beam is more like it beams them to the Enterprise and immediately beams them back down. I was never really quite sure how that worked with a direct beam, but since you don't seem to need the pad, where you land. But perhaps you need to be sucked back up to the pad and redirected somewhere else.
Yeah.
And the consistency there, the door still has a burn mark on it. So good continuity there. Well done. And by the way, earlier on, Gary Seven insisted that World War III would begin in about 20 years. So, right, well, today. So it's about 20 years after World War II. He said World War III was about to start. So that makes it about 20-ish years or so. 24 years or so after World War II in the Star Trek timeline. So I wonder how that jives with the rest of Trek history.
Yeah.
If that's consistent. And I like how Spock kind of plays off the fact that he can't make a decision based on logic here.
Yeah.
So Kirk needs to make a decision without facts. So I think the quote is, without facts, the decision cannot be made logically. You'll have to rely on your human intuition. So is that some sort of an admission by Spock that human intuition has some sort of value? Can do something that logic can't do?
In this particular scenario.
Yeah. Interesting.
I'm sure Spock would find a way to sort of dismiss it at the end of this episode if they had a sort of a tag.
Oh, I'm sure.
Yeah, so there is. I guess there's. Is there no McCoy in this episode?
I didn't see him.
You know, that was just something I thought of. I don't recall seeing McCoy here, which is really, really odd.
That is odd. Huh. Good point. I'll have to go back and watch the early bridge scenes, and maybe he's in the background somewhere.
Yeah.
Or something, because I don't recall seeing him, but maybe.
Oh, actually, yeah, but it will. Yeah, Gary doesn't even end up in sick bay after he's captured at the beginning of the episode.
Well, I think you hear McCoy's voice at some point.
Yeah, well, yeah, doesn't Kirk say he wants some kind of analysis done?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Huh.
But still odd, the lack of DeForest Kelly or McCoy here is, it is definitely, you definitely feel it.
Yeah, it's noticeable. It's noticeable. Well, there goes the missile.
Yeah, Gary saves the day.
So now we know that he is actually a benevolent alien, right? We don't see a lot of good guy aliens on the show. So kind of cool that we have an alien presence that actually doesn't mean any harm to Earth or the Enterprise crew.
Uh-huh. And we get the information that it was detonated 104 miles out,
mm-hmm.
which becomes a very important number.
Mm-hmm.
Because here, Spock's relaying the fact that they didn't interfere.
Yeah. That's the part that is very, very strange about this, that this is the paradoxical part, that Spock insists that the Enterprise was meant to be part of this.
Uh-huh.
But how could they have been a part of it the first time it happened?
Yeah.
You know, they didn't exist yet.
Yeah.
So there is a little paradoxical there.
So now we have a little bit of the ISIS character being developed.
Yes, you actually see for a split second that Isis the cat is a shapeshifter and is actually a woman in the form of a cat. So, would have been interesting to see how it progressed. And Spock is now saying that Gary Seven and Roberta have adventures to come. So there was your spinoff line.
Yeah, and somewhere in an alternate universe, people were able to sit back and enjoy at least a season of Assignment Earth.
Yes, yeah, that would have been pretty cool. I wonder what the name of the show would have been. You think it would have been Assignment Earth, or would they have called it something different?
Assignment Earth is a pretty solid title.
Yeah, but that would kind of limit him to just being on Earth. Yeah, maybe he would want to go other places and do other things.
Good point.
But
good point.
At any rate, the episode is now over, and it is time to do our essential voting. And I guess I tipped my hand a little earlier, and this is actually a first for me,
uh-huh.
Craig. This is a first for me. And this was something that I was not looking forward to being up against, and I've talked about this with people that I know that listen to the show, and they say, Jeff, what are you going to do when you run into an episode that you really like?
Uh-huh.
But is not essential.
Yeah.
And here is the first time I've actually run into that.
Ooh.
This is an episode that I really, really like. And I've never, my love for this episode has never diminished over the years, despite the lack of Star Trek stuff going on. There's not a lot of Trek actual action. But I always really enjoyed this, and for a lot of different reasons. I thought it was fun. I like how it keeps you guessing all the way up until the end, and it's a interesting story. I love the fact that it could have been a spinoff. I wish it was a spinoff. But unfortunately, I can't find any reason to mark this essential.
Yeah, I'll back you up here, as entertaining as it is to watch. And I think you're a little bit more entertained with it than I am. But there's really nothing on display that can make this essential. And actually, it could confuse things a little bit if you actually do watch it, because there's so much going on here that acts to sort of take you away from Star Trek that it might actually be mildly confusing to somebody just sort of starting their journey with Star Trek.
Yeah, potentially, if it happened to be the first one or among the first ones you watched. But again, I'll say to anybody out there who's listening that if you want to take a look at this episode strictly from the this could have been a spinoff angle. Historically, it's a cool thing to watch just because, you know, another glimpse of what could have been.
Yeah, it's like a crossover episode with a series that never happened.
Yeah, exactly. It's kind of like watching The Cage It's the same type of a thing. Like, what could have happened if it stayed this way, or if things were different, where would the show have been, or where would, you know, I love that kind of stuff. And unfortunately, can't market as essential as much as I'd like to. So I guess it's a double non-essential.
Yep. Yep. So that brings us to the end of season two, Jeff.
I know, man. I know it's going so fast.
It is. It is. But it's been a great ride. And, as we talked about in the intro, we'll be back next week with the first part of our two-part look back at season two.
Yes, we will.
The spin-off has been a staple of the television industry since it began in the early 50s. Love American Style gave birth to Happy Days, which in turn spun off both Laverne and Shirley and Mork and Mindy. All in the Family spawned Maude, the Jeffersons, and Good Times. Star Trek has had successful spin-offs in the animated series, Star Trek The Next Generation, Deep Space Nine, and Voyager. But before all of them, Star Trek tried one spin-off that never, well, spun off. The last episode of Star Trek's second season was intended to become a brand new series, a blend of science fiction with The Man from U.N.C.L.E. and a little bit of James Bond thrown in for good measure. It was called Assignment Earth. It was intended that this new series would focus on the adventures of the mysterious Gary Seven and his human secretary, Roberta Lincoln. Robert Lansing was cast in the role of Gary Seven. And in her first major acting role, the part of Roberta Lincoln was played by a very young Terry Garr. Terry would later go on to stardom in such films as Close Encounters of the Third Kind, Mr. Mom, and Tootsie. Even though Kirk and Spock hint at the many adventures that lie in store for Gary Seven and Roberta Lincoln, we never got to see any of them. The spin-off never happened, and Star Trek's second season ended on a disappointing note. With ratings faltering, NBC announced the cancellation of the series. A letter-writing campaign organized by fans and science fiction writers convinced the network to renew the series for a third season. Unfortunately, they put us in the unenviable 10 p.m. Friday night time slot and slashed our production budget. Within a year, it would prove to be the death knell for the original series. Before that would happen, Star Trek's third season would produce a few of the best and some of the worst episodes of the entire series. But that's a story for later.